This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Welcome to Trumpet Hour. This is Joel Hilliker. We have a special program for you today. We're working diligently right now on the next Trumpet print edition. This is our 32nd year anniversary issue, and we're devoting the entire issue to one of the most important and dramatic trends in the world today, the fall of the English-speaking world. This is really a stunning fulfillment of biblical prophecy. It's something that Herbert W. Armstrong wrote extensively about. His most widely circulated book was called The United States and Britain in Prophecy, and it was about this very trend. And in that book, he focused mostly on the rise of the United States and the UK. He traced them back to their roots in ancient and biblical history, and he showed that they are the descendants of ancient Israel. He traced it back to Abraham and his grandson Jacob, whom God renamed Israel. And more specifically, the United States came from Israel's grandson Manasseh, and Britain from his grandson Ephraim. And that includes Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. When Mr. Armstrong wrote that book, he did talk about what the Bible prophesies for these nations. But he gave the most recent update to that book about 40 years ago. It was 1980 that he updated that book. His first draft of it was back in the 1920s. Well, what we're seeing now demonstrates a stunning fulfillment of what he prophesied. And in this Trumpet magazine, we're basically catching readers up to speed with what has happened in the time since Mr. Armstrong wrote The United States and Britain in Prophecy. And we're showing just how accurate he was in that book, in the prophecies in that book. The Trumpet has written and talked a lot about America's decline. This is just a massive, epic-defining transformation of the modern world. And our editor-in-chief, Gerald Flurry, has really provided essential understanding of the spiritual dimension of this trend. But, you know, we have not written nearly as much on how the same trend is playing out in these other nations worldwide, the Ephraimitish nations. This group of English-speaking nations that have a significant shared history to America's. And that is really what we're focusing most of this Trumpet issue on. Now, on today's show, we're going to look specifically on Britain and Canada. We're going to have a conversation with Trumpet writer and native Brit Richard Palmer about some recent history in Britain and the trends that have been eroding Britain's power really for decades. And we're going to follow that up with information on the most recent troubling and prophetically significant developments in that nation. We'll also talk with Trumpet writer and Indigenous Canadian Abraham Blondeau about the same trend playing out in Canada. And there's some fascinating information here. I think each of these countries that we're talking about in this Trumpet kind of has several unique elements. I've actually learned quite a lot from putting these articles together, reading these articles, and putting this issue together. I think you'll learn a lot from these conversations. So I do hope you'll stick around for those interviews later in the program. But let's start by talking more specifically about why we're discussing these nations in particular. The key to understanding this lies in knowing their shared history. They all have a lot more in common than most people realize, and it really points to some of the most inspiring truth you will ever learn. And not only that, but it leads to knowing in advance the outcome of these recent developments that we're seeing in these interrelated nations. America, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, these were all British colonies. We are the same people as the British. We have a common parentage. We have a common ancestry. And when you look at the moral and the political strides that the British people made over a period of centuries, you look at the Magna Carta and parliamentary rule and common law and the abolition of slavery, those developments have extended to all of these nations that were once colonies of Britain. We share a common commitment to the rule of law and to human rights and limited government and the sanctity of private property, personal responsibility, and a really unprecedented level of individual freedom. Now, these nations, Britain and America, have been dominant for over 200 years. And this age of Anglo-American dominance, because of the commitment to those fundamental truths and values, this age has really been characterized by civilizational progress, by technological development, by individual liberty. And these English-speaking nations have raised the level of prosperity for millions of people in nations all over the world. And on several occasions, they've prevented the world from falling into the grip of tyranny. Now, it's really important to know where the British people came from. You can see, you know, where the Americans and the New Zealanders and the Australians, the Canadians came from. Where did the British come from? You look further back in their history. That shows the origin of a lot of the characteristics and beliefs that have made these people very unique. And it's all contained in that landmark book by Herbert W. Armstrong, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. This book really supplies crucial understanding for why the world looks the way it does today. And we put such a high value on it here at The Trumpet that we print it and offer copies for free to anyone who asks for it. It's a big book, and it definitively shows this link back to the biblical nation of Israel. You study that history and you see that Israel was the nation that God founded through one righteous, obedient, and faithful man, Abraham. And you can read in Genesis 12 and Genesis 17, and through that history, God gave this great patriarch spectacular promises of national greatness and said that his descendants would be as numerous as the stars of the sky and the sand of the sea. And he also gave spiritual promises of salvation. But these national physical promises are ones that the world generally overlooks. Now, to Abraham's grandson, Jacob, whom he renamed Israel, God refined that promise by saying, "A nation and a company of nations shall be of you." You can read that in Genesis 35 and verse 11. The company of nations is what we're talking about here. Israel had 12 sons. He fathered 12 tribes that composed the nation of Israel. His son Joseph had two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, whom Israel placed his name on, and he established that the multitude of nations would be descended from Ephraim. You can read that in Genesis 48 and verse 19. Now, the world today basically looks at the Jews as being the modern descendants of Israel. And they are. They are the descendants of the tribe of Judah. That's just one of the 12 tribes of Israel. It's the only tribe that has preserved its biblical identity to this day. But the 10-tribed northern kingdom of Israel broke away from Judah in 928 BC, and it endured a couple of centuries of very wicked rule by a sequence of terrible kings. And it was finally conquered and enslaved in 721 to 1718 BC. Now, at that point, the identity of these Israelites was virtually lost to the world and even largely to themselves. They were subsumed into their captor peoples, the Assyrians. Now, even by the first century AD, Jesus Christ was on the scene, and he referred to these peoples as the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Now, he told his disciples to go to those lost sheep. So they were lost from general view, but God knew exactly where they were. And he had a message that he wanted to give to them and to send to them through those disciples. He was still enacting plans for them. The United States and Britain in Prophecy tells you just what happened to these people. Now, the greatest of the material promises that God made to the descendants of Israel, he conditioned on their obedience to him. And you can read about that in Leviticus 26. So this is all spelled out beautifully in the United States and Britain in Prophecy. But God promised that if they rebelled against him, that he would withhold those blessings, the birthright blessings that were promised to Ephraim and Manasseh for a period of 2,520 years. The clock on that prophecy started when the 10 tribes of Israel went into captivity. So that was 721 to 718 BC. That period of punishment, 2,520 years, ended in 1800 to 1803. And you look at history, and it was right at that time that the British and American peoples exploded into unprecedented prominence and prosperity and global influence. Almost overnight, Britain became the largest empire in world history. It's not like they went around trying to take over the world. It was pretty much like this empire kind of fell into their laps. Now, even after the empire dissolved, it still remains a commonwealth of nations. And this is the company of nations that was prophesied 3,500 years ago in your Bible. The people of America descend from Manasseh, that God prophesied would become a single great nation. The people of Britain and of its dominions, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, these trace back to that ancient Israelite tribe of Ephraim that descended from Joseph, the son of Israel, the son of Isaac, the son of Abraham. So this prophecy ties all of these English-speaking nations together, and it shows how God was the one who brought them to prominence. And it explains why they've played such a powerful role in the world for these past 200 years. On top of that, when you understand the truth of their biblical identity, it unlocks an enormous amount of your Bible to your understanding. The Bible devotes one-third of its pages to prophecy. This God-inspired book, in passage after passage and biblical book after book, God foretold the rise and the fall of specific individuals in cities and people and nations and empires. God alone is able to prophesy something and bring it to pass. He offers prophecy as proof of his divine presence in world events, his active existence and intervention in human affairs. And it also proves that the Holy Bible is inspired by God, that he wrote it. Fulfilled prophecy is undeniable, watertight proof of the reliability of God's word. So a lot of people don't consider prophecy very important, but obviously it's exceedingly important to God. Most people see prophecy as incomprehensible. They don't think it has any relevance to them because they just don't see how it relates to the modern world. But once you recognize that the prophecies of Israel apply directly to America and Britain and these other modern Ephraimitish nations, you gain penetrating insight into the world that we see around us. And you even see what it's going to look like in the time just ahead. Those prophecies show that even though God promised to make Ephraim and Manasseh great in this modern time, he also conditioned the continuance of those blessings on our nation's obedience to him. And there's just so many prophecies in the Bible where he detailed exactly what would happen if they turned away from him. So that's what we're talking about in this next issue of The Trumpet. We're looking at how these prophecies are playing out in each of these nations of Ephraim. These are events that really illuminate God's hand in world events. You look at what's happening in these nations and you can see the miraculous reasons why they've attained some of the greatest heights of achievement in all history. And you can see the factors, very clearly, the factors that have led to their decline in recent decades and then what's happening right now in these nations. And you realize just how cataclysmic their end will be. The story of these nations' rise is so inspiring. And you can read all about it in the United States and Britain in prophecy. The fall of these nations is gut-wrenching. We're watching it happen right before us. Prophecy gives us the broad outline. It also gives us quite a lot of detail. But now we see history and current events filling in the full picture. And it really is devastating to witness. It's so important that we see the spiritual dimension of what's happening in these nations. That's the most dominant factor of what's happening. On one hand, you have the God of Israel, who's intervening directly in human history over a period of millennia to fulfill his promises and provide material blessings to millions and millions of people. You also have the God of Israel warning of the consequences of their rebelling against him, and he's chastening these nations incrementally more devastating ways, really aiming specifically at trying to turn them back to himself. But on the other hand, you have an evil spirit, Satan the devil, who hates everything God is doing and is trying to undermine what God is doing. He's attacking these nations in a focused way. Gerald Fleury has pointed to that prophecy in 2 Kings 14:27 that he is trying to blot out the very name of Israel, which rests on these English-speaking nations in particular. This is the spiritual backdrop of the plagues that are increasing in these nations. You have to see this to understand all these bewildering changes. Once you understand this, then you can take to heart the biblical warnings that conditions are going to get far, far worse before they get better. Mr. Armstrong called the understanding of the identity of these nations the all-important master key to biblical prophecy. He said, "This very eye-opening, astounding identity is the strongest proof of the inspiration and authority of the Holy Bible. The rise of these nations proved those prophecies true. It proves the Bible true. And the current fall of these nations gives us additional powerful proof. It shows that prophecy is real. It is active. It's alive. It's reliable. It's trustworthy. You can put your faith in it. Everything that God said would happen has happened. And what remains yet unfulfilled is happening. It's happening right before our eyes. And those prophecies reveal the end result of the trends that we're seeing playing out right now. And they are a lightning bolt warning that we must heed, or we're going to pay a terrifying price for this." Now, thankfully, those prophecies also show that on the other side of this collapse of these English-speaking nations, there is a glorious hope. So stick around. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll come back with an interview with Richard Palmer about what is happening right now in Britain.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
The rise and fall of Britain really is one of the most stunning fulfillments of biblical prophecy you'll ever see. It shows God's hand in world events in a powerful way. It's something we need to understand to see God and have faith that the prophecies he's given for what lies yet ahead for Britain will come to pass. To talk about this, we have from our office in Britain, trumpet writer Richard Palmer. Hello, Richard.
Good afternoon.
So one of the most stunning developments in history was how Britain came to possess the greatest empire the world has ever seen. And a lot of people look at that history. Obviously, it wasn't perfect. There's a whole lot of people who criticize that today. But there's so much evidence there, not only of how beneficial that empire was to millions and millions of people, but also evidence that God just gave it to them. It's not like they were going around trying to build a world empire. It kind of fell into their laps in a lot of ways. So that was dramatic. The loss of that empire is equally dramatic. They both fulfill prophecy in stunning ways. What do you see as the biggest factors that led to Britain losing their empire?
Well, I think one thing that what really stands out to me is this loss of will, this loss of determination to hold on to the empire, or a determination really to do anything on the international scene. And you could call it, I guess, a loss of morale. The Bible talks about it as being a loss of pride in power. And to me, this is one of the fascinating and even exciting aspects of this kind of study into, well, what caused the decline of the British Empire. because you go and you look at what the experts say, and they talk about exactly this. I've got a quote from Paul Johnson in the article that talks about the loss of vision after World War II. You know, we've just been talking in our international relations class recently about the Klein formula. He was their head of the CIA. He put together a formula for calculating world power. And one of the most decisive aspects of that formula is will, the degree of determination with which a nation follows its foreign policy. And so this lack of will really is what people single out as being decisive in causing the fall of the British Empire. Now, you look at the Bible, and one of the key passages for understanding the rise and the fall of the British Empire is Leviticus chapter 26, which details the prophecies and blessings that God would give his people if they obey him. Or even then, after a certain amount of time, even just regardless, the blessings he would give and then the curses that would follow if they disobeyed him. And right there up front in those curses, God says, I will break the pride of your power. That will be taken away. And this then leads to a whole load of other problems. And that is exactly what you see it with the fall of the British Empire, this decline of will, this loss of vision, this turning inwards. You know, the British Empire was always a project that consumed rather than contributed to the British treasury. And for a long time, Britain was okay with that. After 1945, we weren't. And so it was this turning inwards, this turning selfish, and this internal focus rather than external vision that really killed the empire. And that matches up exactly with what the Bible talks about for the fall of this empire.
Now, the individual identity that Britain developed separate from the continent, this really took quite a while to form. You know, what does it mean to be British? And you see the way that God blessed the British people in preparation for giving them an empire and the inheritance of those birthright blessings. And then as they came into full fruition as an empire, they really were very distinct. Now, what's interesting is once you started to see that breakdown in will that you were describing, that kind of essential Britishness was drastically eroded. I'd like to talk a little bit about the relationship with the European Union, because you know, that history and distancing itself from the continent, which really was a tremendous blessing to generations of Britons, that changed dramatically after World War II. Maybe you could just talk about that relationship, why that changed, and then what the outcome of that was in its relationship with Europe.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent way of putting it. You look at what Winston Churchill said, you know, taking this broad historical view like you did then in terms of Britain's relationship with the European Union. He talked about that it might be a good idea to have some form of European Union. And every time it comes up in Britain, people trot out Winston Churchill as if he's a supporter of the EU. And they chop out the part of his quote where he said, but Britain shouldn't be part of it because of this separate, distinct history and heritage. And he was very determined and very forceful even that Britain should not be a part of the European Union. But once Britain turned its back on empire, there was just even a loss of self-confidence, a loss of ability even to go it on its own, a loss of willingness to take the risks that go with that. And I think you saw that in, say, the Suez Crisis and Britain's unwillingness to take a risk of defying the United States. And that was really seen as a defining feature in the fall of the British Empire. You saw it in all of the retreat from empire. Then you see it in going to Europe as well, where there's no willingness, no courage of your convictions to stand alone. And it kind of feels like, well, we've got to, you just like somebody who may not feel particularly confident might want to surround himself with his peers and his friends and go along with peer pressure. You had that reaction from the United Kingdom.
And where do you see Britain now? It had that dalliance end in a kind of a messy way with Brexit in recent years. It took quite a while to try to figure out exactly how to end that. And I don't know that that's completely resolved just yet. But where did that leave Britain, that relationship that they formed the Union and then broke it?
Yeah, it still has a big impact on Britain today. You know, the European kind of thinking, the heavy regulation of the European Union. Now, some of that I think we embraced on our own accord after World War II, but a lot of that still has a long legacy. European human rights legislation that kind of dilutes human rights by expanding them and spreading them onto like a right to family life and all of this and that, that has basically been incorporated now into the British legal system in a way that's very hard to entangle. And so you see that, unlike, you know, you saw in America and in states, America's quote unquote human rights legislation, the Constitution, worked in preventing some of the worst excesses of COVID tyranny. Britain's, now that it's been watered down by that EU membership, didn't. Because it was your right to freedom was one of a whole number of competing rights that had to be balanced in some very intellectual way. And so I think you see a very lasting result of it in Britain's economy, in Britain's law, and also just in the makeup of Britain and the migration of Britain. You know, there was a deliberate policy under the Labour government to change the face of Britain. When a lot of Eastern European countries joined the European Union, most countries like France and Germany shut their borders to new migrants. And they said, no, for 10 years or so, you can't come because our minimum wage is like 50% higher than yours. Mm-hmm. So, of course, people would come flooding in. Britain was one of three countries that didn't do that. And so there was a massive influx of migrants. And since that time, Labour politicians have come out and said, yeah, we did this deliberately. We thought it would be to our political advantage to have this kind of mass migration. So you have the situation where you had about 1 million different migrants coming in every 3 years. That is about one big city a year of increase. It's getting to the point where 1 in 5 elementary school children don't speak English as a first language. You have 2,000 schools where a majority don't speak English. You're getting to the point where over a quarter of all births in England and Wales are born to mothers outside, who are born outside the UK. So this is, you know, migration has very much changed the pattern of British life. And I think even some of British values and things like this, I find it remarkable watching footage, say, from the 1970s before this explosion took place. And it just, everything, the whole character of the country is very different. And it's not just migration from European countries. Then some of this European human rights legislation with its right to a family life and things like that made it just about impossible to deport terrorists. It opened the door to mass migration from Middle East and North African countries that has also changed Britain and led to a much worse security situation. So there's a lot of that European Union relationship that has fundamentally changed Britain, that in a way that has not been undone by Britain leaving the EU.
Mm-hmm. Richard, just looking back over the broad overview of British history, what role do you see the royal family playing, both in the rise of Britain and now in its fall?
It's a fascinating question. I mean, the royal family in many ways has been at the heart of England's institutional development. I mean, if you start to think about, well, from a rule of law perspective, what makes England unique? And one of the first things that is going to come up is Magna Carta, which is, of course, something signed by a king. In that case, unwillingly, but this whole interplay between king, parliament, barons is fundamental to the whole English conception of liberty. In his book, Crown and Country, David Starkey kind of plays, he does a great job of just showing how a lot of this conception of liberty played out as a partnership between the commons and the king, often working together against the aristocracy that were usually the more direct threats to people's liberty. So I think just a lot of the development of English political thought goes hand in hand with the monarchy, and people will even trace some aspects of this all the way back to the House of Wessex in Anglo-Saxon times. Institutions like the Parliament and things like that. So that goes right hand in hand with that. And then
before you continue there, I think what you just said is very interesting, because I guess from an American standpoint, there's this view that the monarchy represents more of the kind of repressive rule. That has been the case with a lot of kings and monarchs over the millennia of human history, but it is kind of unique to Britain, the fact that the monarchy actually did play such a vital role in enshrining many of these rights and privileges and freedoms that we tend to take for granted, even in the United States.
Yes, that's true. And it's certainly true that some of these rights and privilege were in opposition to the monarchy as well. There was still, you know, a long history of friction there between say Parliament and the king, but you know, the development of the British monarchy is, say, incredibly different from the development of the absolute monarchies that you saw in France and that you saw in a lot of other countries. And it led to a valuing, especially in, I think, in the 18th and 19th centuries, of the role of the monarchy as something that could provide freedom, but also the right kind of balance of freedom and stability, and that it kind of allowed some freedom without tipping into the chaos that you saw in things like the French Revolution, where you had a swing from two very different extremes. So I think that is interesting. And then just this pattern of, say, the interplay of the rise of the monarchy and the British Empire, in even the way, say, Queen Elizabeth I was heavily involved in what's sometimes called the First British Empire or the First English Empire, where you saw England expand overseas for the first time, and often some of those overseas naval campaigns she was funding out of her own purse and was an integral part of that. And then just all the way forwards, it was the monarchy that kind of held the empire together. You can look at, say, the Jubilee of Queen Victoria. I think it was sometime right at the end of the 19th century, was just a celebration of a figurehead that brought together a significant percentage of the world's territory and population under one person. And that was really the one that kind of united them. And her portrait was there from India to Australia to South Africa to Canada, and uniting kind of the world in some respects in celebration. It was the monarchy even that united England and Scotland. It was the monarchy that kind of united the Commonwealth after the empire. So in a lot of ways, it has played a vital role of being a piece of glue that has kept all of these different, very different parts together. And as you see the power of the monarchy weaken, you see bits of the Commonwealth splitting off. You see even the potential for England and Scotland to split. So that unity, I think, is a critical role as well.
Yeah, really, it seems like every aspect of imperialism, anything associated with the British Empire, it's become kind of synonymous with the royal family, and the way that even the young royals of the family itself are talking about that legacy, even the legacy of the Commonwealth, and associating it with the most extreme forms of racism, where it's essentially tarnishing everything associated with that that history that really did make Britain great. That has led to a lot of disaffection and disenfranchisement with the monarchy itself. And it seems that there are a lot of people who are ready to just kind of push this aside as a relic of the past.
I mean, in some ways, the critics of the monarchy are right in that the monarchy and empire go very closely together. Now, they're kind of using that to say empire evil, therefore monarchy evil, which that logic is thoroughly and fundamentally flawed, but they do kind of stand and fall together. And so by kind of rubbishing and demonizing the British Empire, like some of these young royals, like you mentioned, are doing, they're undermining their own stability, and they're undermining the stability of the whole royal family. And then you look at the role that that's played in the stability of English politics. Well, then are you destabilizing even English politics through attacking the empire that way?
Right. I think what you said, that the role that this institution has played in being a stabilizing force in British history, is really one that a lot of people are underestimating. And when this is trashed, then that really does, the effects of that are going to be far more far-reaching than I think a lot of people realize. All of this, of course, is kind of mitigated by what Gerald Fleury has written in The New Throne of David. When you understand the whole picture of prophecy in Britain and with respect to the royal family in particular, you can see just how closely linked, as you said, the fate of one is with the fate of the other. We do have a lot to say about that in our literature. We'll link to The New Throne of David booklet in the show notes for today's program. We've been talking with trumpet writer and native Brit Richard Palmer about the fall of Britain, a part of the larger story of what's happening in the English-speaking world more broadly. He's written an article for the coming print edition of The Trumpet that we'll be sending off to the printer in just a few days. You can watch for that next week on thetrumpet.com. Thanks so much, Richard. Appreciate your time.
Great to be here.
The This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
We'll talk now about one of Britain's most important dominions, Canada. In broad overview, the same story you see in Britain is playing out in Canada, but there are some fascinating particulars we should dig into. To talk about this, we have from our office in Canada, trumpet writer Abraham Blondeau. Hello, Abraham.
Hello.
I think it's interesting, a lot of the trends that we see affecting America today, in some ways, they're further advanced in Canada, our neighbor to the north. I'm thinking of socialist, even communist economic ideals, multiculturalism, open immigration, secularism. I do want to talk about some of those things, but let's start by talking about something that really is unique to Canada, the fact that you have two separate cultures that are coexisting here in that country, and it kind of has been that way since the beginning of the nation, the French and the English. Tell us about that history, what led to that, and then we can talk about some of the implications that has had for Canada.
Yeah, I think that's probably one of the most distinguishing features of Canada, is that you have an English population and a French population. And all this started right when Britain and France were in a world war with each other. And it was at the Battle of the Plains of Abraham where Britain defeated France in North America, and France eventually ceded all territory to Britain. And even just 3 days or so after the French surrender, Britain was already making concessions to allow the French language, culture, the Roman Catholic religion, all to be preserved, and for them to exercise those cultures and those rights freely in Canada. And that was just really unique in the world, especially since that was in 1759, and Britain and France would go on to be fighting each other for another 60, 70 years. But while these wars were going on within Canada, you had French and English coexisting with each other. And what's interesting too is in 1774, Britain was trying to figure out how to deal with the French problem in Canada. Do we try to force them to assimilate, or do we just let them be? And so their solution was the Quebec Act of 1774. And they really did this to try to bolster loyalty in the French Canada. Because in the States, in the 13 colonies, they saw rebellion starting to creep into a possibility. But it actually had almost the opposite effect, because it gave the French the ability to have their own laws, their own customs, and it essentially created their own nation inside of Canada. And so I think the most interesting element of this is in the United States and Britain in Prophecy, Mr. Armstrong identifies France as Reuben, which is the older brother of Joseph, where Ephraim and Canada descended from. And Reuben also lost the birthright. He originally was going to have the birthright, but it was given to Joseph. And so not only is you have an English, French, a Protestant, Catholic rivalry within Canada, you also have a sibling rivalry between Reuben, the older brother who lost the birthright, and Ephraim, a younger brother, a descendant who has the birthright now. And so that's also underpins this relationship in Canada, where you have two ways of thinking, two civilizations, two religions. They're almost always at odds with each other, but they're both given the legal rights to coexist with each other within Canada. And this English-French relationship has really, and the dynamics of it has really underpinned all of Canada's history. And as Canadian history shows, Quebec has really been a destabilizing force in Canada, because they're always trying to make sure the English don't have enough authority where they can take away certain rights or perceived threats against the French culture in Quebec.
In the article that you've written for the coming Trumpet edition, you say if there's one word that summarizes Canada's history and character, it's compromise. And you use this example of the way that the authorities handled the French problem or the Quebec problem as one example of that. And you see the kinds of problems that have resulted from that. Maybe you could just talk a little bit about how those differences, the major differences that have really created the friction between these two in Canada. And is this something that has intensified more recently? You said that it's a destabilizing influence in Canada. We're especially tracking just how these problems have intensified in recent years. Is that something that you see with the separatist movement in Canada?
Yes. Yeah, I think in recent times, Quebec has become more successful because in being separatist. And there is even a period of time where it was very violent, which I'll get to in a moment. But I think the probably one of the most revealing examples is Canada became a dominion in 1867. And basically it allowed biculturalism, so an equal share of power between the English majority and the French minority. And generally, the arrangement worked well for the first 20 years. But as an example of how a French Catholic influence in Canada has destabilized the country was in the rise of Louis Riel in the Canadian West. He was a self-proclaimed messiah of the Métis people, the Métis people are half French and they're half Aboriginal or First Nations. He thought he was a prophet. He thought the Métis people were God's chosen people instead of the Jews. That was his new religion he was trying to create in Canada. And there actually could have been a peaceful resolution to this, but really Quebec and a lot of Catholic church leaders, they influenced Riel to that he did have some kind of special mission, that he should stand up to the Canadian government. And the French really praise him as a French rights fighter. And so it was really a lot of influence from Quebec and some Catholic church leaders acting on their own accord that really fired up this resistance in the Canadian West. This happened in the 1880s, and it led to a rebellion where there was bloodshed. Canada had to send an army out west to quell the rebellion. Riel was later hanged for treason, but it created a sharp divide between English Canada and Quebec for the rest of time. And as we move forward through Canadian history, some other examples really started coming about when socialism started to creep into Canada. And the separatist movement in Quebec really took off when Marxism became mixed in with the French misgivings and the feeling of oppression that they thought there was as a minority in Canada. And so in the 1960s, a Marxist French writer created this manifesto, and it really set off a lot of violence in Quebec in 1970. So this was, it created the FLQ, the Front de Liberation de Quebec, which was a terrorist organization. They actually kidnapped and killed a Canadian politician. They set off several bombings throughout Quebec. This was all an urge for Quebec to become its own country. And in response, the Canadian government did something unprecedented under Pierre Trudeau. He put in the War Measures Act, which gave him wartime power. He sent the army into Quebec to to get rid of the FLQ terrorists. And it gave him a lot of unmeasured power for a little while in Canada. But that really showed how dangerous this the separatist movement became. It cooled off after that, and now it's become a political movement in Canada, which always comes up from time to time. Will Quebec leave or will they stay in Canada? But this example of how the French were really able to change a lot of Canadian laws, they were able to gain a lot of favorable legislation because there was always this threat of separating, and Canadian politicians didn't want violence to return. Did a lot of other ethnic groups, a lot of other minority groups took the same tact, and they were able to gain the same kind of influence in Canadian government as well. Mm-hmm. And so the example of what happening in Quebec spurred on a lot of other divisions within Canada to where the unifying mold of Canada, which was British culture, the British Empire, became now a fractured society where every minority group has and special interest group has a lot of political power. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it stemmed from the example set of English and French relations throughout history.
Well, that's very interesting. And if I understand this right, the way that you were talking about this, the Quebec movement essentially was kind of a backdoor for socialism and Marxist thinking to make its way into more mainstream Canadian thought. I'd like to talk about just how much that has affected the country. We see an extremely leftist prime minister. And this is really, it's been kind of a legacy in recent years and recent decades that it's much further to the left than, say, what we've experienced in America, generally speaking. And it's introduced a lot of, I guess, just to bring it right up to date, the way that the Canadian government has handled coronavirus and the way that they're implementing and enforcing some of these communist type policies on the country has been even more extreme than what we've seen down here. Maybe you could just talk about the trends that we're seeing as this playing out in Canada.
Sure. Yeah, I think that's a great summary. And what's interesting is what we're seeing play out in modern day Canada with Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's administration, especially. You can really trace back the same kind of policy all the way back to his father in the 1960s, Pierre Elliott Trudeau. And this also is a tie to Quebec as well. Pierre Trudeau, Brian Mulroney, Jean Chrétien, and Paul Martin, they were a line of successive prime ministers. They all have ties to the same powerful Montreal business corporation. It's called Power Corp. That's very pro-China, very pro-Quebec, and very liberal. They all have deep business ties there, and they all have, but some are conservative, some are liberal, but they've all had the same political agenda from the 1960s all the way till today. Stephen Harper was the only aberration from that. He came from the West and was conservative. But all these leaders from 1960 to Justin Trudeau have had this policy of pro-China, pro-climate change. And what really enabled Justin Trudeau today was Pierre Trudeau, when he remade the Canadian Constitution in 1982, he put a clause, the first clause in the Charter of Rights and Freedoms is that the government can restrict all rights and freedoms if there's a reasonable cause. So the very first section in the Canadian Constitution says the government can take away your rights and freedoms if there's a legal reason for doing so.
Which they of course, are the ones who define what that is and what's a reasonable cause.
That's right. And in 1986, a bunch of activist judges appointed to the Supreme Court by Pierre Trudeau blew the door open on that clause to allow the government to really abuse it. And if we fast forward that to today, a lot of the extreme, the vaccine mandates, these other COVID restrictions that really take away freedoms, that they're all enabled by that Section 1 in the Charter, because every legal challenge to them has been struck down in the court because they're all deemed to be a reasonable limit to our rights and freedoms for the benefit of public health. And so you can really see how what's going on in Canada today, there's been a steady progression throughout, especially since around the 1960s. And Justin Trudeau has really been able to take advantage of Canadians who have grown used to this way of governing. And they've really made the federal government so powerful that a lot of Canadians find trouble even holding the government accountable or voicing concerns about any of these policies that we're seeing take place. As you mentioned before, it's a spirit, that spirit of compromise. You can see that in how all these policies, skyrocketing inflation, rights and freedoms being taken away, that thinking of compromise that we have to find the middle ground or give them the benefit, the government the benefit of the doubt because they're the experts, they know what they're doing. That way of thinking really hampers the Canadian people from really being able to really question what the government is doing and the direction the country is going in.
Mm-hmm. Well, one last question. It's related to this. You're talking about just Canada basically trying to redefine itself after having put distance between itself and its British roots. We recently saw Barbados declare independence from Britain's Queen, and the push for that exists in Canada. What do you see the chances of that movement succeeding?
Well, as soon as Barbados left, there was a poll up here in Canada that said a majority of Canadians favor leaving the monarchy, but after Queen Elizabeth dies.
Right.
So if Queen Elizabeth died, I think there would be a considerable movement to remove the British monarchy as the head of state. And I feel like that's the perfect opportunity to make Canada the first post-national state, which is what Justin Trudeau said his goal is. Because the last vestige of Britain's heritage in Canada is the Queen as head of state. If you remove her as head of state, then it gives the green light for the government to reform the Canadian institutions, however they seem fit to fulfill that vision. Mm-hmm. So I think based on public opinion and even the actions taken by the government over the last few years, I feel like that's a very real possibility on the horizon.
Abraham, you love history, and I'd like to give you an opportunity to make your best pitch for why people should care about what's happening in Canada. That we're not just talking about kind of a transition from one form of government to another, and you know, people change and nations evolve over time and that type of thing. We're talking about a part of this story that is really one of the most dramatic stories unfolding in the world today. And why should people really be concerned about what's happening in Canada?
Well, I think if people want to see what their nation will be like in a few years, that's why they need to pay attention to Canada. It's really a preview of how all these policies in the States and a lot of other countries, how they will play out in your own country. How your rights and freedoms can be slowly taken away from you to the point where you can't even legally challenge the government. There's nothing you can do to really hold them accountable anymore. So I feel like Canada is it's the mouse next to the elephant. We're right next to the superpower, the United States. But I feel like there's a lot of lessons that can be learned just to see what happens before you before it's too late in a nation that's embracing all these radical ideas.
Well, thank you so much. We've been talking with trumpet writer and native Canadian Abraham Blondeau about the fall of Canada, part of the larger story about the fall of the English-speaking world. He's written an article for the coming print edition of The Trumpet. You can watch for that next week on thetrumpet.com. Thanks so much, Abraham. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Mr. Armstrong called the understanding of the identity of these nations the all-important master key to biblical prophecy. He said, "This very eye-opening, astounding identity is the strongest proof of the inspiration and authority of the Holy Bible. The rise of these nations proved those prophecies true. It proves the Bible true. And the current fall of these nations gives us additional powerful proof. It shows that prophecy is real. It is active. It's alive. It's reliable. It's trustworthy. You can put your faith in it. Everything that God said would happen has happened. And what remains yet unfulfilled is happening. It's happening right before our eyes. And those prophecies reveal the end result of the trends that we're seeing playing out right now. And they are a lightning bolt warning that we must heed, or we're going to pay a terrifying price for this. Now, thankfully, those prophecies also show that on the other side of this collapse of these English-speaking nations, there is a glorious hope. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Richard Palmer and Abraham Blondeau. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Comte de Buffon. Never think that God's delays are God's denials. Hold on, hold fast, hold out. Patience is genius. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.